that there's a reason why I need to be alone. You show me there's a silent place that I can call my own. Is it mine? Oh Lord, is it mine? You know I get so weary from the battle. Many times it seems that you're the only hope inside. Is it mine? Oh Lord, is it mine? When everything's dark and nothing seems right,
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, October 4th, 2020. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. Or if anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week on our scripture reading. We're reading in the book of Matthew. Let me open that up. So we're in the Gospel of Matthew, and we are in chapter 9. So chapter 9 of the book of Matthew is where we'll be reading today. And this is by, hold on a minute, Alexander Scorby. He'll be reading this.
Chapter 9. And he entered into a ship, and passed over, and came into his own city. And behold, they brought to him a man sick of the palsy, lying on a bed. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee. And behold, certain of the scribes said within themselves, This man blasphemeth. And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, Wherefore think ye evil in your hearts? For whether is easier, to say, Thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, Arise and walk? But that ye may know that the Son of Man hath power on earth to forgive sins, then saith he to the sick of the palsy, Arise, take up thy bed, and go unto thine house. And he arose, and departed to his house. But when the multitude saw it, they marveled, and glorified God, which had given such power unto men. And as Jesus passed forth from thence, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the receipt of custom, and he saith unto him, Follow me. And he arose and followed him. And it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, Why eateth your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, They that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. But go ye and learn what that meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. For I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Then came to him the disciples of John, saying, Why do we and the Pharisees fast oft, but thy disciples fast not? And Jesus said unto them, Can the children of the bride chamber mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken from them, and then shall they fast. No man putteth a piece of new cloth unto an old garment, for that which is put in to fill it up taketh from the garment, and the rent is made worse. Neither do men put new wine into old bottles, else the bottles break, and the wine runneth out, and the bottles perish. But they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. While he spake these things unto them, behold, there came a certain ruler, and worshipped him, saying, My daughter is even now dead, but come and lay thy hand upon her, and she shall live. And Jesus arose and followed him, and so did his disciples. And behold, a woman which was diseased with an issue of blood 12 years came behind him, and touched the hem of his garment, for she said within herself, If I may but touch his garment, I shall be whole. But Jesus turned him about, and when he saw her, he said, Daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith hath made thee whole. And the woman was made whole from that hour. And when Jesus came into the ruler's house and saw the minstrels and the people making a noise, he said unto them, Give place, for the maid is not dead, but sleepeth. And they laughed him to scorn. But when the people were put forth, he went in and took her by the hand, and the maid arose. And the fame hereof went abroad into all that land. And when Jesus departed thence, 2 blind men followed him, crying and saying, Thou son of David, have mercy on us. And when he was come into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus saith unto them, Believe ye that I am able to do this? They said unto him, Yea, Lord. Then touched he their eyes, saying, According to your faith be it unto you. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus straitly charged them, saying, See that no man know it. But they, when they were departed, spread abroad his fame in all that country. As they went out, behold, they brought to him a dumb man possessed with the devil. And when the devil was cast out, the dumb spake. And the multitudes marveled, saying, It was never so seen in Israel. But the Pharisees said, He casteth out devils through the prince of the devils. And Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them, because they fainted, and were scattered abroad, their sheep having no shepherd. Then saith he unto his disciples, The harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest, that he will send forth laborers into his harvest.
Okay. By the way, how am I coming through? Testing 1, 2. Coming through okay? Anybody hearing me?
I hear you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, what we'll do is we'll move over into Q&A, and if anybody wants to get into the queue now, you can, star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Okay, tonight we're going to do something a little different. What I did is I started the recording earlier today, and we did take on the song inside the recording because I decided not to upload our meetings. They're quite long, 3 hours minimum, and some of them actually, one of them going up to 4 hours. And I don't know that many people are going to come in and listen to all that. So if they do get interested in what we're doing and they do want to really get interested and look back into some of our earlier programs, they can do that right off of our website. So there's no need to do that on YouTube. But I want to put shorter things onto YouTube, preferably things under an hour, even under a half hour if possible. Tonight may take a little longer than a half hour. I perceive it'll be under an hour. But it's an important subject that I really want to cover. It's extremely important, I think, that we do cover this one. Let me open up the PowerPoint here, and we're going to record not only through this, but I'm going to record live through the PowerPoint itself, and hopefully things will go good enough and we'll be able to post it up onto our YouTube channel, so we'll be giving them subjects and then we'll give them reference back to the conversations of that night or whatever the case may be. So we're going to start off in the beginning here. Let's see. Okay, hopefully all is going to go well on this. All right, tonight we're going to be looking at really the sovereign citizen movement. But we're first going to look to see the beginning of our nation, how things came to be. We're just going to cover a few things quickly. In 1774, we had the First Continental Congress. And, of course, they were meeting because of problems with the king, and it was right after the Tea Party, Boston Tea Party. And I guess there was responses to that, but they were having problems with the king, and so they came together in the First Continental Congress. In the Second Continental Congress, they came together to really start to talk about the Declaration of Independence and the separation from England or Britain. Let me see now. I know why this thing is moving. Let's try this. All right, there it goes. All right, in 1776, we had the Declaration of Independence, and we're just going to read a few key words from this. As in the preamble, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government become destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new servants. And that is the key part of that, is the fact that we the people have a right to alter or abolish the government that we've instituted. And that includes changing the servants. And that is, of course, our intention in the federal courts today, what we're doing. But before I proceed further, I want to make sure, am I coming through okay? At the same time with this PowerPoint? Is the PowerPoint visible?
Yes, and it looks good.
Okay.
I can read it.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so let's go. The key thing, of course, and we've been saying this forever, it's on our front page, only the people can save our republic. In 1787, the U.S. Constitution preamble, and this is when they completed the Constitution, of course, 1789, it took effect. George Washington was elected president, and the Constitution took full effect, and we became a nation. But it actually was concluded in 1787. And I want to make a point here, because when you go into the sovereign citizen movement, I've heard this many, 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 many times. And every person who's ever brought this to me, I always say, well, go get me a copy of it because I need to compare it. The Constitution that I have on the bottom of it, when it's signed, it does say 1787. But, of course, it didn't take effect as far as us becoming a nation. Where, you know, it took time to go through the process, put things together, voting President Washington into as president. And that happened, of course, in 1789. Now, someone did share, well, actually, I went out to Anna von Ritz's website, and she's got a copy of claimed copy of 1787 and 1789. I opened them up. I've got two screens, so I scroll together all the way through. I haven't found one word difference. Whatever they had listed in 1787 is the same thing in 1789, and that's the way I understood it. Any additions or changes that were made during that time process of the Bill of Rights, which came into effect in 1791. But in 1787, they did agree on this Constitution as we see written. And at that point in time, when the Anti-Federalists were making their arguments and saying they're not going to sign it, they did, I think they added some things very specifically in Article 1, Section 9 and Section 10. Okay. Which were prohibitions. Where the government was forbidden in certain things, and one of the things they put in there, of course, was the habeas corpus. But that might have been in there before. I got to go back into the Federalist Papers and see whether that was actually included before that argument or debate, or was it in the argument of the Federalist Papers. But in any event, of course, the Anti-Federalists, those really the end results of that was the Bill of Rights. They were not against. Matter of fact, Jefferson, working with Madison, Jefferson was all for building the federal government, of course, and he was concerned because the other side had taken on the name as the Federalists, so they had to call themselves the Anti-Federalists, only because they were really pushing too much power to the government, and without a Bill of Rights, that document would be. Or could be interpreted as more power, or there'd be no restriction to prevent them from really giving themselves more power. But in any event, in 1787, the U.S. Constitution, the preamble says, "We the people of the United States, in order to perform a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." And that, of course, is another key point, that we the people ordained this, and we had the power and the authority to do so, that God had given us that power and authority when we made a covenant with him under the Declaration of Independence, with the desire to live under his law and not the laws of men, and thereby receive the blessings of liberty. Article 3, Section 2, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and the laws of the United States. And so there we have defined right here that it is law and equity is to rule our courts. As a matter of fact, the court case that we're involved in right now, that is the big argument. And they've taken law and equity, put it together, and call it civil law. And that happened, again, in 1938 through the Rules Enabling Act of 1934. Article 4, Section 4, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion. Okay, and that guarantee, this is what opens us up to be able to go into the federal court for cause, for the sole purpose of summary judgments, really. That's what we're there for. Whenever we go into a court, in a federal court, and we bring something from a state or a lower court, we bring it into the federal court for cause, we're there only to say, hey, we're not here to argue the case. We're here because there is a problem, and it could be a due process problem. It could be a jurisdictional problem, and whatever that is. And the only ruling that a judge could make in this case, and they have the power and the authority to do so, is a ruling on behalf of the individual, the sovereign, bringing the case in saying, I'm not getting due process. Now, the other side has that opportunity to say, hey, wait a second, we did allow him to open the court of law, there is a jury, blah, 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 well, then, of course, they would win that case at that point. But the point is that's not the case, and that's why we're there. And it is the duty of that judge in that federal court to protect the rights of the people, and through that power and that authority that we gave them in the Constitution, they should be ruling on our behalf and giving us whatever it is we're asking in our wherefore clause, and requiring a court of record to be opened. So guaranteeing to every state in this union a Republican form of government. Article 6, Clause 2, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made and pursuant thereof, and all the treaties made of which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. So the supreme law of the land is this Constitution. And that brings us right back to the fact that we, the people, ordained it. We had a covenant with God. Nobody can break that covenant. There are people that think they can break that covenant, and we're going to look a little bit at that. But we made that covenant with God. And anybody who tries to intervene with that, okay, has to face the wrath of God, ultimately, at some point in time. Okay, hit the wrong button, sorry. Hang on a minute. All right, give me a minute, putting that back up there again. Start recording from current slide. Okay, here we go. Okay, in 1791, the Bill of Rights. The conventions of the, and this is in the preamble, the beginning of the Bill of Rights, the conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adoption the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its power that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. Now this key word here, to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, okay, and that's why these further declaratory and restrictive clauses were added. That means that the entire Constitution must be read in light of the Bill of Rights. Anything repugnant to anything in the Bill of Rights is null and void. And that is the key to protect the people's rights. And, of course, our rights extend further than that which we had declared those clauses in the Bill of Rights. Amendment 10, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor forbidden by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And that brings us into some of the problems that we're dealing with today, where they think that they had the power and the authority to come in and create what they call Rule 2, which is, again, combined law and equity together, called it civil law. So we're under Babylonian control, municipality, you know, the law of the municipality, and we are now governed by their will, and not ultimately by the will of the people through the will of God, ultimately under his law, under his will. Okay, the conspiracy to destroy our republic, it started way in the beginning, even before the Declaration of Independence came to be. There were problems, but as soon as we came out with the Declaration of Independence, I'm sure they were aware that we were coming to that point early on. But in 1776, when the Declaration came into effect and we separated ourselves from Britain, then at that point in time, they were already working within our government. They were already in our conversations in the Federalist Papers. And this was some of the problems, of course, that Jefferson and Madison saw. But the Treaty of Verona took place in 1822. And the British monarch and Pope secretly agreed to undermine the American system of government via the Treaty of Verona. The British monarch breaches the Treaty of Ghent, and both the Pope and the King secretly breached their trust as international trustees. They set out on a covert action and issued letters of marque and reprisal, in other words, marked us as enemies in wartime, to the members of the Bar Association, allowing them to act as foreign agents on American soil and as privateers free to plunder American commerce. Therein the reason for the 13th Amendment, which disappeared, which did not permit anyone to hold an office of any kind of a trust if they had, goodness, what they call that, they came in as esquires, a title, that they held a title. Now, the title in itself isn't the problem. It's what was represented by the title in itself. The esquires, they were taught civil law, and the whole process was to destroy common law. They had done that in England. They had been working for that for a long time, and they were trying to do that here in the United States at the same time. And that's how they were trying to assault us, by assaulting our Constitution, our founding documents, to assault our common law, to bring in the minions of the New World Order, because they were around back then. They've been around for a long, long time. And so they were bringing in the minions in order to control the whole process and bring this nation down and underneath their thumb. The answer to the treaty was the Monroe Doctrine, and that was in 1823. Monroe followed Adams' advice and laid out an independent course for the United States, declaring four major points in his December 2nd, 1823 address to Congress. He made four basic statements. Statement number one, the United States would not get involved in European affairs. Number two, the United States would not interfere with existing European colonies in the Western Hemisphere. Number three, no other nation could form a new colony in the Western Hemisphere. And number four, if a European nation tried to control or interfere with a nation in the Western Hemisphere, the United States would view it as a hostile act against this nation. Now, the Monroe Document had come into effect numerous times after the 1823, when it was laid down by President Monroe at Adams' advice. In his Monroe document, he said that the people of the West are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. And we have protected that with exercising the Monroe document and looking at it as an act of war, a hostile act. Treason by enemies, foreign and domestic. In 1871, we had the Organic Act, created a foreign state within a city, forming a corporation called the United States, Inc., owned by foreign interest, moved in and shoved the original Constitution into the dustbin. Now, of course, they call this a conspiracy theory. This is a conspiracy fact, and we have the papers to prove it. We're not going to produce these papers here, but we will post them up on our website. I probably should have done that before this, but we will post it up on the website. And if anybody can't find it after tonight, you can ask on our Monday night programs, and we'll tell you where we put it. 28 U.S.C., subsection 3002, 15A, definition, the United States means a federal corporation. In 1871, in an act of high treason, the 41st Congress acted without constitutional authority, an act of fraud, conspiracy, and subversion against the United States of America, attempting to depose our covenant and our creator, and thereby establishing a totalitarian government unaccountable to we, the sovereign people, under foreign control, behind which the conspiratorial erosion of our Constitution began. This transformed our unalienable rights to civil rights, our republic to a democracy, the United States to a corporation, and the laws of nature's God to civil and criminal laws, which have their roots in Babylon. This placed the United States under the fiction of law And as long as the people believe the fiction to be law, it is. It's a state of mind at this point. But nevertheless, it was right here at the end of the 1800s and coming into the 1900s, the 20th century, is when they really started to stack all of these different acts, which we're going to take a look at, which they used to construct their whole process to bring us under the control. They built a prison, a statutory prison, that we the people have been living in for quite some time. The original 13th Amendment, 1876 is when it disappeared. The treasonous British bar and their esquires, minions of the New World Order, manipulated the constitutionally ignorant Congress to conspire to supplant the law in exchange for money and power, placing themselves in positions of honor that was forbidden them by the original 13th Amendment that was ratified in 1819. We have the papers, and we also have the record kept by Congress, and that this was actually ratified state by state. But anyway, the original 13th Amendment, ratified in 1819 and concealed in 1876, which carries an enforceable strict penalty. Example, inability to hold office and loss of citizenship. Goes that far. There's loss of citizenship for holding the title of honor called Esquire. That was the 13th Amendment. Now, this kind of still holds weight because our, you know, the lawyers, the American Bar Association, the ABA, they do have the word Esquire attached to them. When you become a bar attorney, they attach themselves. And that in itself, they'll say, oh, that's really just on the air. It's not really a title. It's not. No, what it represents is their education. They have been educated as the minions of the New World Order to destroy this nation. And anything of any importance, including your medical needs, is controlled by lawyers. Lawyers control everything. They control absolutely everything. They control our government. You get into a discussion and a disagreement with some bureaucrat, next thing you know, you're talking to a lawyer, because they're not talking no more. They have a duty to speak, but they're not talking no more. And the lawyers come up and they defend them and crush you, whatever they got to do. And this is what it said. If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them. In 1878, 75 lawyers established the American Bar Association. ABA was founded on August 21, 1878. In an act of high treason, 100 bar attorneys from 21 states and the District of Columbia met in Saratoga Springs, New York, to establish the American Bar Association, the minions of the New World Order of the ages. Since that first meeting, the ABA has worked in the shadows, infiltrating our government, our courts, our churches, our institutions, and our media, demoralizing our children, all in an effort to expunge our common law and replace it with civil law, also known as Babylonian law, Justinian law, or Roman law. The legal profession as we know it today barely existed at the time. Today, the ABA is one of the world's largest professional organizations, with nearly 400,000 members and more than 3,500 entities. Today, the ABA holds a monopoly over the minds of the federal and state judiciaries and attorneys that practice law in our courts. Law schools are nationally accredited by the American Bar Association, and graduates of these schools may generally sit for the bar exam in any state. There are 204 ABA-accredited law schools. There are 31 law schools that have not been approved by the American Bar Association. Some states permit graduates of these schools to take the bar examination or will admit to their bars a graduate of a non-ABA-approved law school who has been admitted to the bar of another state. Most states do not. The ABA schools, in an act of treason, teach that in law, common law, also known as judicial precedents or judge-made law or case law, is the body of law derived from judicial decisions of courts and similar tribunals, claiming that the defining characteristic of common law is that it arises as precedents. And we saw that in the court case that we were listening to earlier tonight, in the federal case against YouTube. Today, with almost 500,000 bar members, 80,000 of them are working in Washington, D.C. You know, I should read that again. Almost 500,000 bar members are in, they have to already today, but 80,000 of them are working in Washington, D.C. They are controlling our government ultimately. They have perverted the rule of law, deprived we the citizen people of sovereign people of due process, and have supplanted our Article III courts with jurisdictions unknown. In 1910, conspiracy at Jekyll Island. In November 1910, in an act of treason, six men, Nelson Aldrich, Abram and Andrew, Henry Davidson, Arthur Shelton, Frank Vandelip, Paul Warburg, met at Jekyll Island Club off the coast of Georgia to write a plan to reform the nation's banking system. The meeting and its purpose were closely guarded secrets, and participants did not admit that the meeting occurred until the 1930s. But the plan written on Jekyll Island laid a foundation that would eventually be the Federal Reserve System. In 1913, we have the Federal Reserve Act. The unconstitutional Federal Reserve Banking Act of 1913 gave control of America's economy to a private corporation owned by foreign bankers who answered to no one and regulate the value of worthless notes of debt called the dollar, robbed we the people of our gold and bankrupt America. A conspiracy among Paul Warburg, Edward Mandel House, Woodrow Wilson, J.P. Morgan, Benjamin Strong, Otto Kahn, and the Rockefeller family, the Rothschild family, and other European and American bankers, which resulted in the founding of the U.S. Federal Reserve System, which resulted in the takeover of the U.S. economy on behalf of the oligarchs. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 defies Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5 of the United States Constitution by creating a central bank of issue for the United States. World War I, the Agriculture Depression of 1920, the Great Depression of 1929 were brought about by international bankers' interests in order to profit from conflicts and economic instability. The 16th Amendment was never ratified. And I repeat, everything I'm saying right here tonight, we have the documents to prove every single thing we're saying. And we will post them on our website. And we're going to create a page, so when we do these PowerPoints and then post them onto YouTube, we're going to create a page where any documents will be put up there, and we'll probably put a reference to whatever PowerPoint was played in order to give them the documents for that particular PowerPoint. But anyway, 1913, 16th Amendment was never ratified. The 16th Amendment, which only appears to create an income tax, an act of extortion and sponsor of debtors' prisons via a slave tax, in direct violation of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5, which states, no captation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumerated herein before directed to be taken. Now, the only way they can put a captation tax on the people, it has to be uniform across the nation. Let's say they want to tax people $10 a year, okay? So every state would have X amount of people in it, and I guess they'd use the census for that. I think they referred to that. Yeah, they would use the census for that, how many people in the state, $10 times those many people, and that's the amount of tax that the state has to come up with. It cannot be directly to the people. So they can collect those taxes and get those monies in lots of lawful ways. And then deliver to the federal government for the purpose of supporting the federal government. So they have that power and authority to do that. They've never exercised that. But these people have taken advantage of that idea and have created a tax, which is a slave tax on the people, which is direct. And that's a problem. 1913, the 17th Amendment, treason. The 17th Amendment destroyed the checks and balances of powers in violation of the Constitution, Article 5, which states, no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. The 16th Amendment removed the state's representation in Washington, giving the Senate to the people who already had representation in Congress, thereby depriving states of its equal suffrage. And so in Article 5, which gives which makes it clear that no state should be deprived of its equal suffrage, their say. And remember, you know, the Senate plays an important role of the control of the government. I mean, remember, that's where they decide the judges. All of the people that are appointed by the president has to go before the Senate to be approved. Congress has nothing to do with that. This is a state issue, okay? And they took that away from the states, and they gave it to the people who don't have the knowledge or the ability to really make those decisions. That was up to the governor and the legislators of every one of these states. The power and the sharing of the power, you know, is ultimately, you know, the federal government has a certain power broken up into three branches. You know, they have that power, and there's a balance of power there. But that balance of power, according to the Constitution, is the federal government, the states, and the people. All three, and we the people ultimately rule over the top. We can change this anytime we want. We can change anything we want. But nevertheless, we can add and correct. We can alter. We can get rid of people. And that's what our plan is. We're looking to get rid of all these judges that are just ruling against the people, ruling in opposition to the Constitution, failing to uphold their duties and their oath that they took, that they would uphold this Constitution. But they have distorted the meanings of words. They've changed the meaning of the words, and maybe we'll get to discuss a little bit of that. But and we'll see that. But they changed the meanings of words and making things mean something that it doesn't. But over time, if people accept these things, and they have, then that's reality for them. And only education is going to change their minds and bring these people to the realization of the power and the authority that the people really do have and can take and exercise. And control 100% of our government through the committee man, controlling the political process 100% with the power to recall. And with the grand juries and the trial juries through the administration of that, the people should have total control of that and make sure, because the people have the power and the control, they can indict and then they can judge them in a court of law and make the decisions. They can, the power of nullification. This is a government by and for the people. We don't consent to government just by voting. You know, that's not how we consent to government. We try to choose our representatives that way, but we are not a democracy. We may use a democratic process to elect our representatives and our leaders, but we are a republic governed by law. And that law is the law of the land, and we read that a little earlier. This is the law of the land, the Constitution, law and equity. We chose to be judged by law and not equity, not civil law, not Babylonian law, not Justinian law, not Roman law, but by law, the law of God, the law written in the hearts of men. That's the law that we chose to be judged by. And they have robbed us of that. 100% robbed us of that. Every jury is stacked. Every jury is tainted. Every grand jury is stacked and tainted and controlled. Every one of them. Once in a while, they figure out something wrong. Once in a while, someone brings up the point, hey, this is our government. We have the power of nullification. And when that jury starts to get to that knowledge, they become what they call a runaway grand jury. Or that jury comes to the knowledge in a courtroom and realization that we can nullify all this stuff. We don't have to agree to this stuff because that judge tells us so, and not guilty. You see, the power of the people. We are judged by our peers. And this is the law, okay? And when 12 individuals who are coming in, with a vow to God, with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy, make decisions on these cases, we can rest assured the probability of a mistake is very, very slim. Very slim. Not impossible, but rare in my opinion. If 12 individuals are truly looking with their hearts to decide what's going on and what should be done in this case, they'll get it right. Barr attempted to abolish grand juries, and that ran all the way up until 1939. Here in New York, as a matter of fact, they had a convention trying to change that, and it turned on them and ended up with the people saying, you know, for instance, the habeas corpus will never be nullified. But anyway, they attempted to abolish the grand juries. They attempted to also abolish habeas corpus, and New York said, no, it'll never happen. In March 1922, in an act of treason, the New York County Association of the Criminal Bar announced that it planned a vigorous statewide campaign to abolish the grand jury institution. Former District Attorney Robert Elder called upon the public prosecutors to take the initiative in replacing the inefficiency, ignorance, and traditional bias of a grand jurors. Just think about that's what they're saying about the American people. They're inefficient, ignorant, and traditionally they are biased. You know, of course, they believe in God, so that's a problem for them, especially with Roe versus Wade. But anyway, this is the very same words they used, or similar words, shall I say, really. Similar words, ignorance is being one of them, when they decided to put on Rule 2, okay, and getting rid of common law, natural law, because it was too destructive. The people can't handle that kind of power. That's their attitude, and that's what they said. And you can read about this right up on their website. The United States Supreme Court has this on their website, and we refer to it in our cases, to that page. Testifying before the Committee of Law Enforcement of the American Bar Association, he observed that a judge or some other man learned in statute should participate in grand jury hearings. In Minnesota, attorney Paul J. Thompson urged his state to adopt the Wisconsin system of prosecution upon the order of district attorney. In 1922, Judge Roscoe Pound and Felix Frankfurter conducted a survey of criminal justice in Cleveland and added the weight of expert testimony to those who sought to eliminate the use of grand juries. Pound and Frankfurter reported that juries were inefficient and unnecessary, since trial courts, politically driven men of course, were quite capable of protecting Americans against executive tyranny. Isn't that something? That these lawyers would protect our unalienable rights when they have done nothing but continually destroy them. And they're being taught in law school that they're being taught that common law has been abrogated. And their understanding of common law, when they refer to it, is really, you know, again, court case decisions, trial court case decisions, court case decisions in the appellate court and the U.S. Supreme Court. That's their common law that they claim and that they try to use. But juries were inefficient and unnecessary. We don't need juries. You know, they'll decide for us, or the lawyers will decide our innocence and our guilt. And that's where they were heading. And that's how close it came. Almost losing it all. We've lost too much already, but we almost lost it all. Thank God we didn't, and we continue today. 1933, the War Powers Act. The War Powers Act, also referred to as the War Powers Resolution, or the War Powers Resolution of 1973, is a federal law that governs the president's power to bring the U.S. into armed conflict without first obtaining authorization from Congress, as required under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. Now, of course, you know, the president has that power to defend this nation, but they certainly don't have the power to run a war and continue in that war, and Congress should never support that kind of a war. But that's where we've been ever since World War II, which was the last war ever declared by the United States. They've been operating under the War Powers Act. 1933, the Emergency Banking Act. The United States federal government has been dissolved by the Emergency Banking Act on March 9, 1933. Let me repeat that. The United States federal government has been dissolved. Gone. Poof. They decided this is all covert. They've done this covertly. And anyway, 1934, Federal Reserve, an astounding exposure. Now, this is referencing back to the Federal Reserve Act of, what was it, 1913 or 16, I forget. But anyway, this was put onto the record by Congressman McFadden. An astounding exposure, Congressman McFadden, on the Federal Reserve Corporation remarks in Congress, 1934. On May 23, 1933, Congressman Louis T. McFadden brought formal charges against the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank System, the Controller of the Currency, and the Secretary of the United States Treasury for numerous criminal acts, including but not limited to conspiracy, fraud, unlawful conversion, and treason. He said, and I quote, Mr. Chairman, we have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks, hereinafter called the Fed. The United States has been ransacked and pillaged. Our structures have been gutted, and only the walls are left standing. The petition for articles of impeachment was thereafter referred to the Judiciary Committee, and yet has yet to be acted upon. Don't know why that's not going. Let's try it again. All right, there it is. 1934 Rules Enabling Act. It gave the United States Supreme Court the authority to write their own rules. In 1938, U.S. Supreme Court betrayed the people. On September 16, 1938, a day that will live in infamy, 8 of 9 men, 1 resigned. The United States Supreme Court, steered by the subversive ABA, authored the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, particularly Rule 2, thereby committing an act of treason, deserving of the ultimate penalty natural law has to offer. Their evil, reprehensible covert exploit is responsible for multi-millions of deaths and destroyed lives. They may have escaped justice in this world, but we trust that they will meet with God's wrath when they passed, or they had met with God's wrath when they passed. So they came together with and created the United States Supreme Court, created the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And in Rule 2, which abrogated common law, and every Supreme Court since has allowed that to rest and stay and sit as law or rules, and they rule as law in order to change us over to civil law, they're all guilty of treason, every single one of them, and they all know what they've done. Of course, we keep giving them the olive branch, we're giving them that opportunity. And once the deep state is gone, that olive branch will no longer be available to these people. And we will, I'm sure, go forward to do many indictments. And we're going to have to consider some of the hardest indictments, and that'll be indictments against the United States Supreme Court justices. That's something that may have to be considered. But we'll see what happens once the deep state is gone and what they're going to do with what we've been doing in the courts for the past so many years. They are dishonorable, the individuals that the judges believe, Supreme Court. They are dishonorable Justice James Clark McReynolds, dishonorable Justice, that's repeated, dishonorable Justice Louis Bandies, dishonorable Justice Pierce Butler, dishonorable Justice Harlan F. Stone, dishonorable Justice Charles Evan Hughes, and dishonorable Justice Owen Roberts, dishonorable Justice Hugh Black, and dishonorable Stanley Foreman Reed. Those were the Supreme Court justices that allowed to go through the rules of the court, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, I can only guess at this point, and I haven't been able to figure this out yet, but it seems, that, in my opinion, I think, that the rules of the court prior to that were the rules of common law. that the rules of common law also, they should be guidance and the equity courts. Now, I can understand them working out procedures of evidence and things of that nature. That makes sense. Let's do that. And okay, fine. But they've gone far beyond that. Bretton Woods Agreement. United States surrendered to the centralized banking system. The prevailing economic system of the world is based on Bretton Woods Agreement, which was established after the Second World War. While all the countries thought that the economics of the world would boost and the people would have more money in their hands, little did they know that it was just a plan to destroy the currencies of the world to make the dollar the currency anchor of the world. And of course, that eventually connected with oil. In 1947, CIA and NSA, creation of a national police surveillance grid. 1948, the United Nations. The United Nations is an intergovernmental organization that promotes international cooperation to create and maintain international order. The UN was established in an effort to establish a one-world government. The UN also supports population control by supporting government programs that promote forced abortions and coercive sterilizations. The 1950 report on the National Lawyers Guild revealed an ABA communist plot. 1954, the Dodd Report. Norman Dodd, investigator for the Rees Committee on Foundations concerning un-American activities in government. The findings of the Rees Committee were very revealing. It was found out that the big foundations were promoting internationalism and collectivism. And ultimately, that's communism, or Marxism, or not, or any of the isms. By their subversive funding activities, they posed a clear threat to American democracy and way of life of American people. The foundations were monumental in shaping the education and foreign policy of the United States. And not only this, but the foundations had their presence in all areas of society, and in some areas had become more powerful than the federal government. Research and experimental stations were established at selected universities, notably Columbia, Stanford, and Chicago. Here, some of the worst mischief in recent education was born. In these, Rockefeller and Carnegie established vineyards working many of the principal characters in the story of the suborning of American education. Here, foundations nurtured some of the most ardent academic advocates of upsetting the American system and supplanting it with socialist states. In 1971, Southern Poverty Law Center. By the way, they have a couple of papers on us, the National Liberty Alliance. In an act of high treason, the law and lies, the SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center, intelligence report proclaiming to be the nation's preeminent periodical monitoring the radical right in the United States is fueling all government agencies and police departments into believing that anyone that uses specific words like militia, sovereign, oath keepers, constitution, patriots, and even founding fathers, to name just a few, are armed radicals and dangerous cop killers whose names are put on a terrorist watch list. This aggravation often caused police to overreact with excessive force and on a few occasions respond by SWAT when these words are used in traffic stops. Much of the overreaction that fuels the police comes from that spewed forth the lies of the Southern Poverty Law Center to unsuspecting law enforcement agencies and departments. The SPLC is the arm of the bar whose purpose is to excite violence by the federal agents and police upon we, the sovereign people, who are trying to make sense of our out-of-control federal judiciary and be free. 1993, James Traficant's bankruptcy speech. Speaker Representative James Traficant Jr. from Ohio, addressing the House, revealing the bankruptcy of the United States into the congressional record. All United States offices, officials, and departments are now operating within a de facto status in a name only under emergency wars powers. With the constitutional Republican form of government now dissolved, they decided to get rid of it. Remember, we the people ordained and established. We made a covenant with God. They had no power, no authority to do anything except to obey our will. And yet they have decided to discard it, to get rid of it. Let me go back and read this. Are now operating within a de facto status in the name only under emergency power, war powers. With the constitutional Republican form of government now dissolved, the receivers of the bankruptcy have adopted a new form of government for the United States. This new form of government is known as a democracy, being an established socialist communist order under a new governor for America. 2001, Homeland Security, police state surveillance grid reached its maturity. 2013, John Kerry signed the United Nations Arms Treaty, gave up our rights to have weapons, to have a gun. 1913. Today, outcome-based socialist education, keep the slaves ignorant. And we indeed have become slaves to these people, and we're waking up today. And we need to do something about this. You know, President Trump said that he was elected to return the power back to the people. Now the people have to receive that power. The problem is they don't know how. They're slaves. They're uneducated in these areas. They have no clue on what to do. Therein the reason for National Liberty Alliance. Therein the reason for the book, Government by Consent. Anybody who reads that book has everything they need to know. Of course, you can further educate yourself really get a lot more. We have a lot on our website on that. But anyway, here is the difference in the problems, and I've been investigating, looking in the past week or two into Anna von Rich's plan, and this is up on her website. I don't know that we have the website up here, but you can probably just Google her name and find her website pretty quickly. She appeared on the scenes 1 year after National Liberty Alliance started its movement with the grand juries. And she, within a year after that, all of a sudden, she appeared on the scenes. And she appeared well-funded. She seemed to be everywhere. And it seems everywhere we went, we found her, or people, not necessarily her personally, but people, you know, representing what she's doing, in other words, part of her movement. And she's teaching a lot of the stuff that we just talked about, okay? But she has some major faults in her thinking and in her conclusions, and we're going to look at them, and I think people are going to see this very quickly and clearly. And again, this is coming from her website, so we're not just making these words up and making statements. It's coming from her website. Anyway, it seems in 2014, that's when she seemed to have seized control of the sovereign citizen movement. As soon as she came out, there was this movement that was already in, but there was really no leader. There was a lot of people talking about this. Gerard and I, we've learned from a lot of these people all this stuff, and we were trying to figure out things, and we also considered, as a matter of fact, I filed a paper making my declaration of my sovereignty and filed it in my county, and many other people did too. But when it came down to getting rid of your driver's license and your Social Security number and not being able to vote no more, getting rid of your citizenship, that became a little radical, and it forced me to really start to dig deeper. And none of those things are necessary. None of those things make any control. But let's take a look at this. Anna von Rich, her plan is to organize 50 jural assemblies up and running and fully populated. Now, that's a big task because she's looking for numerous people in every state, and they're nowhere near as organized as they'd like to be. I mean, we're far more organized than them. And we have touched all 50 states and got people involved and are really trying to get the power of the people at the grassroots to step up and take control of their government. And that's our purpose, is to do that. But anyway, she's looking to do the same thing and to call them jural assemblies. And to populate them with people who have corrected their political status, actual state nationals and state citizens, by correcting the record, misidentifying the people as U.S. citizens, by filing a declaration terminating your citizenship, and therefore, these are the points that she is making. And again, this is on her website. You will no longer be subject to federal statutes. So if you do this, go get rid of your license, go get rid of your Social Security card, make a declaration, separate yourself from the government. And by the way, once you're no longer a citizen, guess what? You could be deported. Okay, it doesn't matter that you're a national, you could be deported because you're no longer a citizen of the United States. That possibility exists, and you'll be an individual, a man or a woman, without a nation. But anyway, the claiming, if you do those things, you will no longer be subject to federal statutes. You will become exempt from paying federal income taxes. You will no longer worry about federal agents breaking down your doors. You will possess your homes and your lands and your soil as freeholders, not tenants. You won't pay any mortgages or utilities or property taxes. You will have no reason to ever visit their courts. You will be in control of your own lives. You will sleep sound in your beds again. And I can tell you this is not true. I know people who have done this, and I know people who are in jail. I know people who have gotten their doors broke down because they've done exactly what she's saying. And anybody who thinks that they're going to go in and make a claim in a court, and you can see that what we're dealing with, those people who are earlier meeting today concerning an indictment against a federal judge, where we played the recording of that judge, and what took place in that courtroom. If you think that judge, you're going to make these claims and click your heels and find yourself transported into the courts of justice before a judge like that, well, that's insane. I got a bridge in Brooklyn. Okay? Anyway, this is the promises, and they're false promises. It's never going to happen. Okay? And by the way, we built these courts. We paid for these courts. We pay to keep the lights on these courts. We pay their salaries. We own their courts. They owe their obedience to us. We're the masters. They're the servants. But they think that they're the servants because they've twisted words and changed things around. Step one, give up your U.S. citizenship. Step two, recharter the federal states. In other words, rewrite our Constitution. Can you imagine? Where is Jefferson? Where is Franklin? Where is Madison? Where is George Washington? Where are all these people that could possibly rewrite our Constitution? Our Constitution is a great, great document. But in any event, this is part of their plan to recharter the federal states and change the Constitution in a radical way. And hold a Continental Congress, which, by the way, we have already done that. So only the people can save the Republic. We, the people's response to the treason. Okay, now that what we just spoke about on that one page really kind of lays out her plan. But, you know, they do use all the things we spoke about up until that page, concerning all of these different acts that government has done, whether it be the Rules Enabling Act and the execution of those rules and so on and so forth. You know, all of that is true, and that is used by the sovereign citizens, but their conclusion is wrong. Once you start to go against them in the way that the sovereign citizens are moving to do this, once you go that way, in that position, in that direction, okay, you're really giving them credibility because you're acknowledging them as some power and authority. We take a different approach, a different focus. It's very simple. It's fraud and treason, and they need to pay for it. It's that simple. It doesn't get any worse than that. You know, we have Trafficant who went up against them, and what happened to him? I believe, you know, there's a possibility he was taken out, but I'm not sure on that. But I do know the other individual back in the 30s who we read about. I can't think of his name at the moment. But his life was, they came after him two or three times. I believe it was three times. The third time they succeeded, they killed him. Because he laid on the record the truth of what was going on. He laid the fraud out. Okay? Now, we have a window of opportunity. Never have we had such a window of opportunity to be able to step up and talk as bold as we talk about because of what President Trump is doing to take out the deep state. And when that deep state is gone, we, the people, have that opportunity to take back control of our nation. And if we fail to do so, we may very well lose. No, let me change that. If we fail to do so, we will lose that window of opportunity, and it'll never be available to us again. So the people need to step up, bone up, and take control of this nation, of their government. And again, that's what National Liberty Alliance is all about. In 2002, Truth and Taxation hearing held by We the People in Washington, D.C., concluded that our courts of law are closed. And this was covered by C-SPAN. In 2004, we held a conference to restore constitutional order held by We the People. And this also was covered by C-SPAN. As a matter of fact, we have... I'm not sure which one. I think it's the Truth and Taxation hearing. We have all of that on video, and we also have it documented in writing. It's up on our website, and people can go through and listen to that. I talked with Robert Schultz, who led that whole process, and he gave me the permission to put that up on the website for people to download or listen to. 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court denied answering the question concerning the right of redress of grievances. Can you imagine that? And this, again, this took effect from the work that was done by Robert Schultz in 2002, 2004, which led up to him suing the courts and with the question, and took it all the way up to the United States Supreme Court concerning the right of redress of grievances in the First Amendment. And the United States Supreme Court, as all of the other courts below them, refused to answer. Think about that. 2009, the Third Continental Congress, they met. Elected delegates from 48 states met in St. Charles, Illinois, and produced the Articles of Freedom. We have a copy of that on our website also. 2010, Articles of Freedom delegates served on U.S., United States government, all three branches, and all states, all three branches, in all 50 states. National Liberty Alliance was founded in May 2013. The purpose of NLA is to provide an online national venue where the people can organize, communicate, and learn the science of government by consent to restore our republic. As the swamp is drained and power removed from the deep state, a vacuum will occur. And if we the people do not educate ourselves and fill these positions of power, our servants again will. And it will only be a matter of time before we find ourselves back under their tyranny again. 2015, Common Law Grand Jury served a writ quo warranto on the federal government. That means cease and desist. And ultimately, we're talking about the ink. 2016, extraordinary action. We filed by the Common Law Grand Jury with over 100 documents, and we were met with silence, and we continue to file and sue. And we are nailing the papers to the door, and they're going to have to answer it one day. And that day is coming soon. 2016, draining of the swamp. President Trump started dismantling the deep state. August 14, 2019. The Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury secured a docket number in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. Let me correct that. It was the Northern District. For the Northern District of New York to be under judicial auspices and to act as a depository for papers served upon government's elected and appointed servants, filed habeas corpuses, joinders, and indictments of judges and other judicial officers. And we've been doing so since August 14, 2019. On August 17, 2019, we filed a decision and order and declaration to restore the law. September 3, 2019, we filed a decision and order concerning the merging of equity and law, where they claim to have abrogated common law, and thereby our Declaration of Independence, gone. United States Constitution, gone. Bill of Rights, gone. The only problem is, people don't know it. September 9th, 2019, we filed an indictment against Judge Kahn, and this was the second indictment, as a matter of fact. He kept trying to close this court down and prevent us from filing our papers to be under the auspices of the court. We would have continued even if he would have succeeded. He has succeeded in keeping it off PACER, but they are receiving our papers, they are being filed, and we are filing it also with the bar and with the president, and we also are serving copies on to the United States Supreme Court for their edification. September 16, 2019, filed. Fake law and fake courts. We made it clear on the record. September 25th, 2019, we filed writ mandamuses concerning Federal Rule 2. September 30th, 2019, we filed writ mandamus concerning information on the Republic. We're not a democracy. October 7th, 2019, we filed writ mandamuses, two more writ mandamuses. November 16, 2019, we filed an amendment to two moved for cause. We were suing the governor and the Congress here in New York State for trying to enlarge gun control here in New York, and we moved that into our court case. December 17, 2019, we filed concerning acts of treason concerning Federal Rule 2. February 19, 1920, we again filed writ quo warranto and others concerning the Second Amendment. I think that was a refiling, actually. April 6, 2020, we filed a review of the record. April 6, 2020, we filed IRS a writ quo warranto. Now, you know, since then, we filed others. On August 31st, 2020, we filed writ mandamus to the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, we filed other papers since then, and we just haven't gotten into this, but there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of things going on that we're working with, and people should really get involved and take a look under our tab, Grand Jury, and you'll see the actions that we're involved in. Only the people can save the Republic, and this is our plan to save the Republic. Educate the people, whereas Thomas Jefferson said, an enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic. Self-government is not possible unless the citizens are educated sufficiently to enable them to exercise oversight. It is therefore imperative that the nation see to it that a suitable education be provided for all its citizens. Now, it seems like Donald Trump is heading down this road, and we need to connect with him concerning that and have a participation in that to make sure they don't have any of their pabulum going into the education of our children. But nevertheless, this is what National Liberty Alliance is all about, is to bring this education, the proper education. We also are looking to bring this into the schools, and of course we wrote the book, Government by Consent. And it is so important, can't even overestimate this. It is so important that people get involved in our campaign for constitutional sheriffs. Find it on the front page, click on that box, it's only a couple of inches down, you'll see it, campaign for constitutional sheriffs. Click on it and participate. because if we don't educate our sheriffs and ourselves, I want to tell you, we got over 3,000 sheriffs in the United States. And if 3,000 people educate themselves and 3,000 sheriffs educate themselves, you got 6,000 people pressing towards the Constitution to be applied not only in our states but also in our federal courts. And that's a powerful movement. And during that process, we will be rebuilding the militia. And we will working with people to teach them to become the committeemen to take over the political process, to have the power for recall, and the people to take over the judicial process to administrations for the grand jury and the trial jury to make sure that they are properly informed, to make sure that they are not tainted, that they are not stacked, and that we do have courts of justice open and the power of nullification in the people, but the people understanding their true place in government. People are part of the government. We have government by consent. And yet, as ignorant slaves, we have no clue on how to exercise that. But we have it now, and people need to do something about it. NLA's mission is to empower the people on a grassroots level in order to have government by consent again, thereby taking back our judicial and political processes, resurrecting the elected committeemen in every state, and building jury administrations composed of five people in each county. I added a person because we do need a secretary to control all of the workings of the four administrators and to work with them. So there'll be five people. One must be a secretary, educated as one. NLA's mission is to empower the people on a grassroots level in order to have government by consent again, thereby taking back our judicial and political process, resurrecting the elected committeemen in every state, and building jury administration composed of five people in each county. The duty of these administrations is to orientate, counsel, assist in the writing of the indictments, informations, assure untainted petted and grand juries, and be the investigative body for the grand jury. Our government structure that our founding fathers created is still intact, and once President Trump drains the swamp, we the people must take control of the two power structures, the judicial and the political, and replace our servants. Any of these servants, any of these people who are not willing to obey the law at that point and to protect our unalienable rights that by the oath that they have taken, then we need to indict and or remove them in other ways. We can remove them through recall. That takes too long, though. These people that have been involved in this are evil. They have broken the law, and they need to be held accountable. And so, therefore, indictments is the proper remedy for this. 18 U.S.C. Code Subsection 2, Principles. Whoever commits an offense against the United States, aids, abets, counsel, commands, induces, or produces, or procures its commission, is punishable as a principal. Whoever willfully causes an act to be done, which, if directly performed by him or another, would be an offense against the United States, is punishable as a principal. So anyone involved in any of this is punishable as a principal. The de facto government holds power because the people believe that the fiction is reality. A proper education will reveal the truth and thereby empower the people. They will awaken to the fiction and demand a reality. We the people have been providentially entrusted via natural law to dispense justice and were provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of the judiciary and our representatives. We the people have the unbridled right by law and in law to impanel our own grand juries and present true bills of information, indictments, and presentments to the Court of Justice, which is then required to commence a criminal proceeding under natural law, and we have been doing so since 2015. When injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. Thomas Jefferson. We have a duty to do this. We, the people, ordained and established the Constitution for our government. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new servants. Declaration of Independence. 18 U.S.C. Code, subsection 2, we read just a little while ago, I think on the other page, we'll read it again. Principles, whoever commits an offense against the United States for aids, abets, counsels, commands, reduces, or procures its commission is punishable as a principal. Whoever willfully causes an act to be done, which if directly performed by him or another would be an offense against the United States, is punishable as a principal. They're all guilty. If we were to indict every guilty person in our government, Washington, D.C. would be a ghost town. Our capital, our state capitals would be ghost towns. But we are offering them the olive branch. Some of them, it doesn't matter what they do, because they've done such terrible acts and destruction, they're not going to be able to escape judgment. But many of them have been stuck between a rock and a hard place and trying to figure out what to do and how to get out of it. And if they see and take opportunity to what's coming up for them, they'll get out of it. But other than that, they will have to definitely pay the price. President Trump said, "In America, the people govern, the people rule, and the people are sovereign. I was elected not to take power, but to give power to the American people where it belongs. The problem is that the people don't know how to take and implement that power." Thomas Jefferson said, "I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves. They must take control. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power. And if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it is expecting what never was and never will be. For enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic. Self-government is not possible unless the citizens are educated sufficiently to enable them to exercise oversight." Anybody who thinks that they can exercise, this type of a thing, without a proper education is fooling themselves. If they think that their rights are going to be protected, if their rights are, they're going to be able to exercise their unalienable rights, and their children is going to be able to do that also, if they don't take control of this government, they're only filling themselves up, with falsities. It's just not going to happen. So it is therefore imperative that the nation see to it that a suitable education be provided to all its citizens. Educate and inform the whole mass of the people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. You know, we have that opportunity of the Great Awakening. By educating our children and participating in our government action, taking control, getting rid of the politics and the political process, okay? And the word politics does identify with the science of the political process, but politics is the word we see and understand is just evil, one side against the other. Let's go back and listen to what George Washington had to say in his farewell address. He made it very clear that parties do nothing but destroy. We don't need parties. We don't need, there is no right, there is no left. There is just law and order or disorder. And, one side fighting against, what are they fighting for? You know, they have no constitutional authority to make all these bickerings for power and authority to put one above the other. They don't have that power. They don't have that real authority to do that. Okay? We don't need them to be doing that. We need to just make sure they obey the Constitution. And if there's a deficiency found, then they can get together and talk about it and see if they can work out a solution. And maybe, if necessary, a constitutional convention for that issue. The mission and purpose of National Liberty Alliance is to provide an online... Someone has to mute themselves. The mission and purpose of National Liberty Alliance is to provide an online national venue where the people can organize, communicate, and learn the science of government by consent and exercise it as at the grassroots in all 3,134 American counties. If the righteous many do not confront the wicked few, then evil will triumph. President Trump. Okay, that brings us to the end. Okay, took a while to shut that off. Okay, that brings us to the end of that. I'm looking at the clock. It's 10:44, so I'm not going to take any questions that have been mailed in. I'm going to move forward to, and turn things over to Gerard and Brent. Is there any important announcements that need to be made, Jan or Terry?
Well, we do have the Red Pill Expo coming up next weekend.
Okay.
The 10th and the 11th. That's a really interesting group of speakers they have assembled, about 20 of them. It's sponsored by G. Edward Griffin. He's the author of the
Jekyll Island.
The Creature from Jekyll Island, and the meeting is going to be held on Jekyll Island. Now, they have any number of really great speakers. Edward Griffin is going to talk about more about the creature. The title of his talk is "The Creature is Wounded and Dangerous." And then we have Del Bigtree, who's a TV producer. He produced the movie Vaxxed. He's a world leader in the vaccination safety movement. He's going to talk about the coming vaccines will save none, but will injure or kill millions. It's true. We are winning the war against forced vaccinations. David Icke, I don't know how many of you are familiar with David Icke. He's a Brit. He had a meeting in Trafalgar Square here on August 29th, and he got tens of thousands of people to come to Trafalgar Square. He's going to be live by remote, and you can ask questions, any questions that you might have of him. We have Andrew Kaufman. MD. He's going to talk about the pandemic fraud runs deeper than you think. If the public knew that the underlying germ theory is wrong, there would be no vaccine sales. Then we have John Rappaport. He's an author and investigator and reporter. He's been exposing deep politics since 1982, and that's a long time. His website is called No More Fake News. His topic is going to be millions will die from the coronavirus. Again, the cult of COVID, like all cults, is based on lies and blind faith. We have Carrie Rivera, and for those of you that have kids or know people who have autism, she has developed a routine, protocol, procedure, whatever you want to call it, and has helped 1,500 children recover from autism so far, and she's using a treatment that is safe and cheap. Alex Newman will explain how fear of an imaginary pandemic creates acceptance of the society. Yes, John.
Jen, you should pull that information concerning the autism and that individual's name, website, or any information you can. And we should put something on our front page of a website. Well, actually on the right side, so it's on every page, concerning the opportunity for people to, especially with children with this problem, that there is a cure. But go ahead.
Right. Right.
So
now,
get that information to me, you know, paragraph or two, and I'll post that up. But go ahead.
Okay.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
She's a homeopath, but I think she's using MMS. I think that's what her protocol is. But
yeah, really? Oh, that's good.
She's been using MMS for many years. I've been following her about 5 years, and she started out with first she.
Well, let's try to get a communications with her. Maybe she'll talk with us, and we can work together with some things. So see if you can contact her. But go ahead.
Sure. Okay, another speaker. And by the way, this you can live stream this. So you can still sign up for it, $45. And you can live stream all of the speakers. I believe there's about 20-some total for 60 days. $45 for 60 days. Go in and look at any one of them. Replay it as many times as you like. It's $215 at this point, I think, to attend the conference if you're anywhere near Jekyll Island. If I was close enough, I would wouldn't hesitate at all. I'd go over.
By the way, when they got together, Griffin with Schultz and numerous other people, when they discussed the Continental Congress, they did it out there to make that plan for the Continental Congress, the third Continental Congress, that met in 2009. They went out to Jekyll Island to put together that process. But go ahead.
Okay, we have Mickey Willie is going to tell his story. It's about how a recovering socialist came to produce the documentary Plandemic, the most banned and most viewed internet film in history. Bradford Weeks is an MD. He's going to talk about hydroxychloroquine, quinine, and other treatments for COVID, or whatever you're going to call it, that are safe, effective, and cheap. And there is, if you go to their website, and I put the information in the newsletter, you have the website link and as well as some more information on it. Just go there and you can look and you see all the other speakers that they have in line. It's a really a great combination of people. And G. Edward Griffin never puts together anything that isn't top drawer. So I would encourage anyone that has the slightest inclination to.
Yeah, we owe a tremendous amount of gratitude and for the work of Griffin. Griffin started his work. I know his first documentary came out in, I believe it was 1959, and he's come up with, I don't know, he must have done about 30 of them. We have them all up on our website, by the way, and. He is really the guy that really did his homework to reveal to the people all these conspiracies and get them out. And when YouTube came around, you know, they've been posted all over the place, these video documentaries. But, yeah.
Okay, that's all I have, John, other than questions. So why don't you move on?
We're going to move the questions till next week. I'll, you know, because we just don't have time. It's getting too late. I want to move on. Unless there's something you think is real important or short.
Well, there is one that keeps popping up. Maybe, John, you'd like to address it.
Okay.
It's about the lawsuit. It says on the lawsuit, we claim to be the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. How can we then be the plaintiff also? How does the court allow this?
Yeah, we addressed that before, but I think it was last week. Terry brought it up, and you had disappeared. But we'll address it again because it is a big question. No, we are not the tribunal in this court. We are the people coming up with the complaint, and the tribunal will be a trial jury, a jury of 12 people that need to be drawn out of a, drawn ultimately would drawn from our, membership here. We have over 9,000 people to draw from. So we're going to look for 12 individuals to sit as jurists. We can't be the jury. We are coming in on behalf of the people making the case against YouTube and Google and Facebook and Twitter. And what's the one I'm missing that is another one? But anyway, we're making the case for the people against them, and it'll be up to the trial jury to make their decision on that.
Okay.
We're not playing both roles. That would be unjust.
Okay.
And we'll take them, you know, right up front. Maybe we'll try to take those questions next week so that we can catch up. How many do we have laying around about?
Oh, we're probably up to 4 pages now.
You better talk to Terry because we did cover some of the stuff when you weren't available. So, okay, well, that one we did cover before, so I'm sure there's others you might have. But, okay, we'll deal with that next week.
Yeah.
Gerard, are you ready to take the controls here? Calling Gerard. Did we lose him? No, he's here. He's muted. Unmute yourself.
What are you bothering my nap for?
Yeah, I know. Put you to sleep all the time. Okay, you ready to take control here?
guess. I don't know. What am I taking control of?
Well, the controls, you know. You're the controller.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to move over to Brent Alan Winters. He's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law and various other books, and his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. Gerard, you got the control.
So if you said Brent, he disappeared.
I know, he ran away from us.
He's gone. What'd you do?
Brent, you there? It looks
I'm
like
here.
He fell.
Am I here?
You're there here. You're here.
I'm heard.
Okay.
Am I being heard?
You're being heard.
Oh, good. Okay, here we go. Thank you.
Be a little louder if you can. You're a little low, I think.
Okay. Maybe this makes it better, huh?
There you go.
Okay. You're sounding awful dim as well, Gerard, for some reason. I can barely hear you.
I don't know why that is.
Yeah, he is a little low, but I can hear him pretty good, so he's okay.
Okay.
Most of us, I guess, but go ahead.
Okay, John. This is Brent. Brent Alan Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. Well, lawyers seem to be one of the focuses of discussion here, so I'm going to read you a section. Section 3.10.2, titled Character of the Common Lawyer. Character of the Common Lawyer, from the book Excellence of the Common Law, Comparative Law Text, Comparing the Law of the Land, or Common Law, with the Law of the City, also called the Civil Law. Before the 14th century, common lawyers, that means lawyers in common law countries, law of the land countries, as opposed to law of the city countries, and there was only one common law country in the world back in the 14th century, and that was the island of Britain. That was it. America hadn't got her motor up and running yet to amount to much anything, neither had Canada. Both Canada and the United States are common law countries now. And then Australia, New Zealand, and then England, Britain. Well, those five major countries are the only common law countries in the world. There are other smaller places just as important in and of themselves, the Bahamas, Belize, in other words, all the former British colonies, former parts of the British Empire, the common law countries, India. India is not a common law country, but it uses the common law quite a bit because that is a colony of India. All of the rest of the world, every country, is under some form of the law of Babylon, the law of the city, and most often most of those other countries are under the code of Justinian, the old code of the Roman Empire that was compiled under the auspices and at the behest of the Emperor Justinian. To sum up, there are only two traditions of religion, law, and government in the world, the law of the land and the law of the city. And then there's all the variations in between, but fundamentally there are only two variations in between on the spectrum. Before the 14th century, lawyers in common law countries called themselves serventes ad legem, or something like that. That's Latin for servants at law. They called themselves servants at law. Lawyers in law of the city countries, like France and all the countries in South America and all the communist countries, view themselves as servants of the state. That's another way to demonstrate the difference. It's not that we don't see eye to eye with these other countries. No, we're looking in opposite directions. We're opposites, not just a little bit different. opposites at the foundation. And that spells all the difference about every other characteristic of those two traditions of religion, law, and government. During the 14th century in England, about the time common law courts stopped using law French, common lawyers began to call themselves by the English term for feudal sergeantry. Feudal sergeantry. What's feudal sergeantry? That means feudal servants. Feudal servants, and they call themselves, therefore, sergeants at law. Now, what's a sergeant at law? Or they'd say sergeant. That's an old word that means servant. Servants at law. We have in the Congress, master at arms. In the naval service, there's always a man or a group of men called master at arms, servants at law. A master at arms is, well, he's an enforcer. Arms, weapons. A sergeant at law is a servant of law. At, the preposition at denotes where he is, what he's doing. For example, and this was the use of the preposition at, and in those phrases we've retained it, but not anywhere else. Here's a good example. I like this example because it's something that really happened. A demonstration of the use of the preposition at in the phrase servant at law. Back in the 14th century, a man by the name of John Wycliffe, for the first time, translated the entire Bible into English. He didn't have access to the manuscripts of the original tongues, the Hebrew and Aramaic of the Older Testament and the Greek, Koine Greek of the Newer Testament. So he used the Latin Vulgate, Jerome's translation from about 400 AD, a Latin translation. That's all he had, so he translated it in English. But he translated John chapter 1, verses 1 and 2 like this. Now listen to this. Remember, we're demonstrating the use of the preposition at in Old English, which we still use today with master at arms and servant at law. He translates this way. In the beginning was ye word. And ye word was at God. Ye word was at God, and of course when you read on through the second verse, he says in our modern translations we say in the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. He was in the beginning with him. Well, who's he? He's talking about Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. And but in English, John Wycliffe translates that the word was, Jesus Christ, was at God. Now, the word at has, in Old English, had an idea with it that means with. The English translations say the word was with God, translating the Greek preposition there. So the word at has the idea of at, right with. If something is at me, two ways I can take that. Either it's coming at me, or it's in my presence. It's right beside me. It's right up close to me. At. Well, that's the way they used the preposition. And so these common lawyers called themselves servants at law. In other words, they call themselves the right-hand man or men of the common law, doing the common law's bidding, defending the common law, enforcing the common law, and remember, The common law is not a list of laws. It is a way of life. It is a path you get on. It's due process. The course, as the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 says, the course of the common law. It's a way we do things. Not what we do, but how we do it. That's the important point about our common law. The law of the city doesn't care how you do it, just so you reach the result that the state commands through its legislation. But we follow a process. Well, servants at law, the early common lawyer's old use of the preposition at is scarce nowadays, but was customary in the 14th century. Common lawyers intended at to denote that their calling was an immediate, peculiar, and personal servitude to the common law. And that means to due process. Our common law does not include due process. Our common fundamentally how we do things, due process. The course we follow in doing anything. As distinguished from personal servitude to the king, to be a servant of common law, when that phrase arose, was to not be a personal servant to the king, or to the, in that day, to the pope, because the civil law lawyers called the Roman priest, that's what a Roman priest is, he called himself a servant to the pope. Well, if you're a servant to the pope, or a servant to the dictator, or a servant to the governor, or a servant to the, well, some other person in government, well, then that person is the law to you. Well, that's a very dangerous position to take. We just have an incident in Michigan. Doctors, medical doctors, sued the governor of the state of Michigan. Well, she claims she's the governor. Who knows who she is? It's all like these are weird creatures doing the things they're doing. I don't know what they are. Anyway, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously on one count and 4-3 on another that the governor, or the person calling herself a governor, has gone beyond the bounds of the law. And they said that what she's doing is unlawful. What was her response? Her response was, she said she was terribly disappointed at the Supreme Court's ruling, but she wasn't going to follow it. She was going to try to persuade. She was going to try to persuade the court differently, and she was going to keep doing what she was doing. That's the upshot of it. Well, how does she justify that? She doesn't. She just says, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. She's too ignorant, I'm convinced, just listening to her. She doesn't have a clue what she's doing. She's just a girl having fun because now she can play governor. And she says, wow, maybe Joe Biden will win the election and he'll appoint me to one of his big positions and I can have a wonderful career as a politician, et cetera. Apparently, somebody's promised her something because she's acting wacko. But can she do what she's saying she's going to do? Well, sure. As a matter of force, she's going to arrest her. She'll just keep doing it, keep saying, everyone must obey my orders. By the way, I've been to Michigan. Hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, are not obeying her orders. I'll drop a footnote here. I want to drop a footnote. People talking about the ins and outs of what's constitutional and what isn't, talking about the ins and outs of what medical science says and empirical science about the virus and blah, blah, blah. I'm just telling you for my part. I don't give two hoots and a holler what any of them say because I just don't care. I do not care and I refuse to participate in the buffoonery that I see and I've seen for decades. I quit participating a long time ago. You either go my way or I'll go by myself. I'm done with it. I hope you feel the same way. You're not going to persuade people who are not persuadable. If God has not opened their eyes to the buffoonery of this so-called virus that does not exist, well, people say it does exist. Well, show me one sliver of evidence that's trustworthy that says it exists. Well, the government says it exists. The health department says it exists. Well, you're going to say that's trustworthy, the government? Well, the doctors, the medical community says it exists. You're going to say that's trustworthy after what they've tried to pull on you. Well, now they want to pump you full of vaccinations, the pharmaceutical companies. Well, there are exceptions to all those generalizations, but friends, neighbors, and kin, I'm not God. I generalize. Why? Because that's the prudent thing for any sensible free man to do. I see the pattern, and I go with the pattern and say, I'm not going there. Oh, there may be, it's like somebody said, well, somebody said, oh, there's some good policemen out there. Well, maybe. Burden's on them to prove it. If they're really good, why don't they get out and quit supporting? Well, there's some good people wearing masks that just do it for the right reasons. Well, there's exceptions to every rule, and of course the exception to the rule is what establishes the rule. But it doesn't swallow the rule, and when I see that people in government, congressmen, courts going haywire, the burden then's on them to prove that they're not part of the system. And if they refuse to denounce it and get out, get away from it and be their own man, oh, I'm not interested in talking to them or paying any attention to anything they say. And if you haven't gotten there, you're not a free man yet. You got to get there. And it needs to be said and said over and over again. Well, the early common lawyer's use of the preposition at is scarce. I'd read that, I guess. Well, I'd read that too. One's personal service to the king. Remember, I must say, I'm reading from the comparative law text, Excellence of the Common Law, section 310.2, the character of the common lawyer, where I try to, well, I recount the history of how we got these creatures called lawyers in common law countries that are different from the countries of the law of the city. One's personal service to the king was called, well, they had a fancy Latin name for that too. Well, it was honorary, such as bearing his sword and armor or in battle, or serving as his champion in battle. Likewise, the sergeant at law's duty and loyalty was personal and honorary, but to the majesty of the common law. In addition, this is why modern common lawyers, as lawyers in common law countries, refer to litigation in common law courts as an action at law. Law being the abbreviated term for common law, and the prepositional phrase at law meaning in the personal presence of the law's majesty. Just as servantes ad lex meant in the personal service or the personal presence of the king's majesty. Moreover, by the title sergeant or servant at law, common lawyers intended to contrast themselves with the Roman priests, serving as civil law proctors, advocates, and judges. The Roman priests, by their oath, had sworn to render their direct loyalty, and still do, by the way, their direct loyalty and service to who? The Pope, the Pope of Rome, whereas the common lawyer's oath, loyalty and service, were direct to the common law. If you don't see this distinction, refuse to acknowledge this distinction, you cannot understand what a common law country is and why we have common law. How did it get here? It came here because of the adversity between the law of the land and the law of the city. The law of the city represented primarily by the Roman priesthood. And the law of the land, the canon law of Rome, is the Code of Justinian in its ecclesiastic form. And the law of the land by common lawyers. And common lawyers arose to meet the threat of Roman priests appointed as judges in England and using the canon law, the Code of Justinian, in their decisions. They wanted to stop it. Because if they knew if they didn't stop it, somehow, by organizing against it, that the common law would be gone, and along with that, freedom, trial by jury, the right to keep and bear arms, freedom of speech, freedom of religious affection. The list goes on. Separation of powers, independence of the judiciary, independence of the legislative branch, independence of the executive branch, and on and on. Unlike the loyalty of the Roman priest and the civil servant of government, which was to the government of a single will, whether pope, bishop, king, or any other combination of men, a common lawyer's undivided loyalty was to the principles of the common law. He was to seek commonness with other men on the objective foundation of law's truth and never upon the subjective and shifting sands of earthbound rulers. You see the contrast. Is our loyalty to be to men? No, no, 1,000 times no. It is to be to the will of the true sovereign. And remember, the will of the sovereign, whoever you take to be your sovereign, his will is law. Well, our loyalty is to law, the law of the land, as our Constitution puts it. The common lawyer, that's a lawyer in a common law country, was to be in constant pursuit of the timeless law's articulation of truth, believing that if he keeps on seeking, as said Jesus Christ, he will discover, discern, and refine the law's fitting application in individual instances. Matthew chapter 7, verses 7 through 8. I'm quoting the Savior. He said, "Keep on asking, and it shall be given to you. Keep on seeking, and you shall find." The translations say, "Ask, and it shall be given." Keep, and but that's not what it means. It's in the present continuous action form of the verb. Keep on seeking, keep on asking. Do not faint, says Paul the Apostle in prayer. Keep doing it. You may feel like your prayers are bouncing off heaven and it's turned to brass up there. Well, you still keep doing it. That's your duty. Well, let me look here and see what I want to omit and what I want to keep. Or what I want to say. Constant pursuit of the law. Only servants at law held the title, in Old England, Order of the Coif, C-O-I-F, Order of the Coif. Sergeants at law were the highest rank of lawyers in common law England. It's still true. Now, the term Order of the Coif was another term they used for sergeants at law. And now that term in America is just used, it's a fraternity now in law schools. And if you make really good grades, you can be invited to belong to the Order of the Coif. It doesn't amount to much. And I add too, hasten to add, the title, Sergeant at Law, Order of the Coif, even Esquire, none of those titles are hereditary. None of those titles are hereditary. They're like ecclesiastic titles. The title of bishop is not hereditary. Of course, those fellows weren't supposed to have children anyway, so it didn't make any difference. Of course, they usually had dozens of children, but they didn't pass along their ecclesiastic titles, bishop or canon or rector or whatever they were. They still don't. And the same thing is true of common lawyers. They don't pass along the titles that they have received. They're not hereditary. In that sense, they're not titles of nobility. A candidate's entry into the order required approval of the Chief Justice, a candidate in England, to get into become licensed, to have permission to argue for another person before the court. That required approval of the Chief Justice of the Court of Common Pleas. The Court of Common Pleas was the chief common law court in England. The chief badge of the authority bestowed by the Order of the Coif, that's the sergeants at law, was a tight-fitting cap worn on the head. A tight-fitting cap. When you look at old paintings of men from the Middle Ages, they'll have these tight-fitting caps. I was talking a while ago about priests didn't have to worry about their titles passing on to their children because they weren't supposed to have any, and if they did have any, they were bastards. In other words, they were born out of wedlock. One of the most famous men born out of wedlock to a Roman priest was a fellow by the name of Erasmus. Erasmus, he was a Dutch Roman priest, and he was incurably Roman. He was a priest, loyal to the church, but he is the one that started the Reformation in Europe. He didn't realize, he got to thinking he was smarter than Jerome, and he wanted to offer a Latin translation to the Pope that was better than Jerome's. He wanted to prove it. He did. But to show how good his translation was, he put the Latin text on the left page, and on the right page, every time you turn the page, on the right page, he put the text, the original text from the original Greek New Testament, right beside it. So you could compare and see that it was more accurate than Jerome's translation. Well, by publishing the Greek New Testament, he didn't know he was playing with matches in an exceedingly dry timber. And it caught fire real quick, and people were saying, now, wait a minute, if this is what the Greek text says, because they could look at it and study it, see, well, why is it Jerome translated this way? Or why is it so-and-so priest saying this when the Greek text says this? And that's what kicked off the Protestant Reformation, the translations of the Bible into the native tongues of the European people. And we're still in that evolution. Well, that's a bad word, dangerous word to use, evolution. In that event, it's still ongoing. The chief badge of authority, as I talked about the cap, the tight-fitting cap upon the lawyer's head. Well, of course, they have other ways they denote a common lawyer in England. They wear those goofy-looking white wigs over in England. We don't do that here, fortunately, and I can't imagine how hot that would be in a hot courtroom, because 80% of the heat in your body, you know, comes out of the top of your head. And if you put something on top of it, oh, by the way, winter's coming. Just remember, if you get cold, put a sock hat on your head. That'll do more to keep the heat in than about anything else. You wear a coat, too, but if you can't get one, put a sock hat on your head. Well, English kings allowed members of the Order of the Cope to wear these caps in their presence. English kings allowed members, in other words, common lawyers, to wear these tight-fitting skull hats in their presence. By the way, they were more like a hood. They weren't a skull cap like the Jews wear. This thing went clear around your head, kind of like something you'd wear in the wintertime when you were cold, and until the year 1553, as did Roman monks, sergeants at law rode mules instead of horses. Let me repeat that. Of course, a lot of people don't know that Roman monks in those days only rode mules so people would know who they are. They never rode horses. Well, these common lawyers that were organizing against them, they took up riding mules too, and never horses. And by their habits, customs, and lifestyle, the early servants at law of the common law meant to show themselves that their devotion to the common law was as strong, if not stronger than, the Roman priest's loyalty to the Roman pontiff. That was the idea. Therefore, by their title, servant at law, which means hand servant to the common law, and by their oath, common lawyers were foremost for the benefit of the people and not the state. God has not made people for the benefit, listen to me, God has not made you for the benefit of the law, but rather God has given the law for the benefit of his people. How do I know? Because Jesus Christ said exactly that in Mark chapter 2, verse 27. And he used the Sabbath principle as the jumping off point when he said, man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath, the law of the Sabbath, was made for man. Well, that applies to all true law. It's for our benefit. We are not for the law's benefit. However, the common lawyers say that they are servants of the law in the sense that they are sworn their loyalty to the law. When we take an oath in America, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, we are taking an oath to what? We're taking an oath to a set of principles written down on paper. The way government is to operate. The relationships between the states' governments and the general government in Washington, D.C., and between the three branches of government and the relationship between the government and us. It's a document not about what will happen, but what about how it's supposed to happen. The course of the common law. And we take an oath to that. When I got overseas, when I was a young punk of a kid, I found out real quick, because we were around people from other countries that had taken an oath to serve their country. French people, I remember, Australians, Brits primarily. But the French were a little different. People from the Netherlands. These other people from these other countries didn't take an oath to support a set of lawful principles written down on paper or somehow recorded. No, they took an oath when they joined their military service. They took an oath of loyalty to an emperor or an empress, to a dictator or a dictatress, or a combination of men together who exert a single will in legislation. America is very much different, but not a little bit. We don't take an oath to the President of the United States. We take an oath to support and defend even the buck private 17-year-old kid and the seaman deuce right on up to the general officer and the admiral. Take the same oath. And they're responsible to stick to that oath, even if it means obeying or disobeying the orders of the President of the United States or the general officer or the admiral. That's our common law tradition. It's different than all of the rest of the world. And if we don't see the contrast between us and them, we will not preserve what we have that is such a blessing to us. If you don't even know there's a difference. If you can't see it, if that's not what you're constantly stressing in your mind, your thinking, in your speech, no, we're not like them. We are wholly other. You know, you go to the Bible and you see real quick, if you read through the Old Testament, you can pick up on the idea that everything, all the will of God that God gave to his people, Israel, in all of that, he said, be ye set apart for a special purpose. That's what holy means, kadosh in the Hebrew. As I am. You are different than all other people, and I want you to appear different, act different, respond different, do things different than all these other nations and tongues that live around you. Because if you don't, you won't preserve your identity, you won't preserve your law, and you won't preserve your freedom. Well, the same thing is true of us. That is a first principle of reality. If we don't follow it and say, hey, wait a minute, we're different. We're different. Our loyalty is to the will of the sovereign. What is the will of the sovereign? True law. How does he express his will? The laws of nature, unwritten. Lex non scripta. In nature around us, in creation. Meant to be observed and followed, or suffer the consequences. And the laws of nature's God, says our Declaration of 76, written. Lex scripta, the Bible, says William Blackstone, in his commentaries on the laws of England, our common law. Well, after the year 1600, the only way to gain eligibility for an appointment as judge in England's courts was to first become a sergeant at law. which means servant at law. Now, when I say, excuse me, I'll keep going. A servant at law. Judges and servants were peers in fellowship. That didn't mean they're part of the peerage. I'm just making the point. The word peers, by the way, peers, is a cognate of our word pears. What does pear mean? P, not P-E. We were cleaning pears today. Peeling them, getting boiled them down, put them in quart jars. 45 gallons of picked pears. Well, that's different than P-A-I-R. P-A-I-R. And P-A-I-R, it can also be expressed as a match, M-A-T-C-H, two things that match. The word peer means those that match you. They are your mirror image. They look like you. They, in general, they have your same standing, your economic condition, same culture, same tongue. You know each other. And, of course, we apply that to the trial to trial by jury, a jury of peers. But judges and servants at law, both of them were servants at law. Here's another feature of our common law tradition that's different than every other country in the world. Our judges appointed to the bench in common law countries, in most all cases, are practicing lawyers. Somebody says, well, that's the problem. Well, of course, it can be a problem, but just to make the point, that's different than every other country in the world. If you're going to be a judge in Sweden or Russia or communist China, you don't study to be a lawyer. You don't study the law. No, you go to school to learn how to be a judge. Well, what does a judge do? A judge in those countries is part of the civil service ranks, like in the federal system, GS-10 or GS-12. That's what they are. They don't know anything about the law, don't care to. Their job is to enforce the will of the state. That's all it is. They're cogs in the machinery of the government. They're not in fellowship. Listen to me close. They're not in fellowship with the lawyers that argue for the court. They're not like them. They're not peers with them. They're not the same kind of people. Not at all. Is that bad? Oh, that's terrible. Freedom won't last when you do that. Why do I say that? Well, when a lawyer goes into court, and this is true, it's a matter of reputation. When a lawyer goes into court, he has something in common with the judge. What is it? They're both lawyers. And because they're both lawyers and he has something in common with the judge, he also has something in common with his client. He's not a judge. His client's not a judge either. The lawyer is a lawyer. The judge is a lawyer. But the client's not a lawyer. So that means that the lawyer arguing on behalf of his client can stand between the judge and his client and identify with both of them. Identify with both of them. To some degree, hopefully. And the better, you know, a judge can get used to a lawyer in a small court and come to trust that lawyer when he tells him this, that, or the t'other. Matter of fact, the ethics code for lawyers in a common law country, different than civil law countries, says that the judge must accept as true what a lawyer tells him until proven otherwise. Of course, that causes problems, and it's up to the other lawyer or the other litigant to call the lawyer out if he's a liar. Does it happen? You bet it happens. It happens a lot. But I'm just trying to make a distinction between the way we do things and the way the rest of the world does things. And I find an analogy here also. The Bible says there is only one mediator between God and man. The Bible says that that mediator is our lawyer who pleads our case. Well, who is it? Well, it's the man of God's own choosing, Jesus Christ. But he is God Almighty reduced to the span of a man, to flesh? So he can identify with the judge, who is the supreme judge of all the world, says our Declaration of 76. God the Father, he's on the bench. Jesus Christ is a member of the Godhead with him. But also, Jesus Christ is like us, born of woman, tempted at every point, just like us. We can identify with him, and we're supposed to. And he identifies with us. And he can stand in the middle and identify with both parties and make an argument on our behalf. And by the way, God the Father, sitting on the bench, trusts Jesus Christ when he tells him something. When Jesus Christ tells the judge, his Father, he believes what he says. Now, if you've got that kind of an advocate going for you before the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is, including you, well, you got a good lawyer. So be encouraged about that. And I hope to shout that he is your lawyer. Because if he is, you've won your case. And he will keep reminding the judge that you've won your case. In fact, he'll remind the judge that he won it for you. That's enough to giggle about. Well, let me finish this paragraph. Can I get to the end? I've got just a couple to go here. Maybe I can do that. Well, sergeants at law ranked just below knights, but just above a knight's assistant. Listen, we're talking about esquires here. The knight's immediate assistant, which was usually a teenage boy, an armor bearer, was called esquire. That wasn't a title of nobility for him either. He couldn't pass that one along. Now, knighthood, that's a title of nobility. But a lawyer was not in the peerage. He didn't have a title of nobility, a common lawyer, as they call them in England and Canada yet today. That's what they are here in America, but we don't call them that very often. So a knight was part of the peerage. Paul McCartney is a knight. Paul McCartney of the former group The Beatles. The Queen, Lizzie, knighted him. That means he can pass that on to his children. That's a title of nobility. Just below him, though, then was the non-peerage. And just below him was the sergeant at law. He had rank in England. And he was also, later on, not then so much, he was called a sergeant, which means servant at that time. But below him was the esquire, the boy that carried the armor for the knight, who was part of the peerage and could pass his title along. Well, both sergeants at law, servants at law, and sergeants, they call them surgeons, they were landed freeholders of land by military tenure, ranked below knights. Knights were part of the peerage. I'm repeating myself. But in the United States, some append the title Esquire after the name of American lawyers as an abbreviated title of courtesy. ESQ, Esquire. The term so used, however, signifies neither class nor peerage. Moreover, the Constitution bars both the United States and any of the several states to grant any such title of nobility. It's against the law in America. Let me read that. This is part of the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 9, and Article 1, Section 10. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office or profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. No state, it says, shall grant any title of nobility. So what our Constitution forbids is any government in our country from granting a title of nobility, and from any person in our country from accepting a title of nobility from another country. Now we have things like, for example, Kentucky colonels. Kentucky colonels are only bestowed, I believe, by the governor of Kentucky. Originally, the Kentucky Colonels was a veterans organization like the American Legion or the VFW, and it was an organization for veterans of our war for separation from Britain. They were called the Kentucky Colonels. But today, the governor does bestow that title to people, but again, it's not hereditary, so it's not unlawful, it's not a title of nobility. In any event, the title Esquire for a lawyer is a misapplication in light of history. Why do I say that? Because originally, English barristers held the title sergeant, which means servant of the law, but never did they hold the title in Old England of Esquire. That was the fellow that carried the armor for the man who was knighted. In addition to their tight-fitting caps to distinguish their position, until the year 1694, the servants at law in England wore robes of varying colors, but always of the same cut. The sergeant's robes, that's servants, influenced John Jay, who was on the first panel of the United States Supreme Court. They influenced John Jay to begin the United States Supreme Court's justices' custom of wearing robes. Many American state courts, such as those of Kentucky and Missouri, resisted judges wearing robes until well after the year 1900. In his prologue to Canterbury Tales, which was back during the time of John Wycliffe, the author of Canterbury Tales, Geoffrey, I think is the way you say it, Chaucer, he was a sergeant at law, servant at law, he provides a 14th century description of the sergeant at law's dress and manners. And maybe you read, we did when I was in high school, we read the Canterbury Tales. Well, I think that's enough. Thank you for your indulgence. Took a little longer, but my comments are my own, and they may or may not be the position of the leadership of National Liberty Alliance, but then again, they may. And I appreciate, as always, National Liberty Alliance allowing me a few minutes to say a few words. You can get this book, though, I want to mention. Oh, join me. Join me on Saturdays. We're teaching a due process class. Saturday mornings, go to commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com, and you can click on a link there and you can participate. It'll tell you how to participate. It's early in the morning. Oh, let's see, West Coast time. Central time, 10 to noon. And you can extrapolate out from there when it would be where you are. And we are recording them, I think, and posting them too, from what I understand, and on the website, commonlawyer.com. Back to you, Gerard, if I didn't put you to sleep. And then we have silence. Maybe, just maybe.
He'll wake up in a minute.
He'll wake up. Gerard's a working man. He's trying to keep a business up and run a family. Children and grandchildren.
I heard my name.
Yeah, there you are, Gerard. Okay.
I've got to find my microphone here.
I can hear you a little bit. Pretty good, actually.
Where the heck did it go? How did I get lost? Hang on. I'm buried in stuff here.
And by the way, you can see Gerard on Wednesdays on Patriot Soapbox. And he's as relaxed on Patriot Soapbox as he is on Monday Night Calls.
I don't think I've snored on there yet.
and you can see him on Patriot Soapbox, by the way, if you've ever wondered what he looked like.
Yeah. Don't give away my secrets.
Well,
that's top secret, don't you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't.
We're having a hard time hiding when we're on this public platform, Gerard, you know.
Well, you got to either hide or you got to come out like a lion and get louder. That's the only two things you can do. You can't be.
Yeah, well said.
So, anyway, let's time is it? We got maybe 15 minutes. I could take a question or two. I'm going to get right at it right away. I'm going to open up Steve and let's see what he's got to say. We've had kind of an interesting night here. Go ahead, Steve. You're open. Oh, I guess he was snoring with me. Unmute yourself, Steve. Well, actually, you're not muted. I don't know. Maybe you can't hear me. Going once, going twice. We now have something like 12 minutes. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and hit Terry from New Jersey. I think he's ready. Go ahead, Terry. You've been unmuted,
Hi.
Terry.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, questions, statements, good. What do you got?
Well, I was reading something about Breonna Taylor, the woman who was shot up in Kentucky, you know, six times by the cops, and a prosecutor came back with no bill. Now, he's being asked to resign. They got like a petition, I don't know, several thousand names to ask to tell him to resign. And I was wondering, do you have any thoughts on what the implications of that are? Because it's really, you know, this fly in the face of everything that we've been talking about over the years, that the prosecutor is usurping the power of the public.
Well, I'll tell you, that story kind of escaped me because I was so busy with everything else. And I really never got looked into the meat and potatoes of it. So I don't feel comfortable commenting
right.
on it because it's one of them ones that sort of went under my radar. I heard about it, but I really didn't pay attention to it. I know they used it as an excuse for more rioting, but today they use anything as an excuse for rioting, you know. So I guess if they left, you know, the prosecutor came back, what happened to the grand jury? Where was the grand jury on this thing?
The grand jury, you see, that's the thing about it, is that the prosecutor never presented the case to the grand jury in the sense that he didn't present murder charges or manslaughter or anything like that. See, that's the whole thing, is that the it's a very peculiar case because what the prosecutor did is he just presented evidence that one of the cops fired an inadvertent round into a neighbor's house. And they completely ignored the fact that you know, this woman was killed in her own home by these three cops and was shot six times. Now, of course, you know, she thought that it was somebody else breaking in. The cops didn't identify themselves. The cops say they did. And so, you know, it's very funny, you know, how this goes because, you know, that you've got really a... This is really what should be going before the grand jury, not before... Cause the prosecutor is saying, no, we're not even going to look at this.
Yeah, something.
Whether the cops did anything wrong.
Yeah, that's bad. And it doesn't look. It doesn't even look right, for one. Whether you think they were right, wrong, or out, whatever, they should have left it up to a jury of, you know, a grand jury of her peers.
Right. Well, that's what got me kind of outraged because she got the real high profile civil rights lawyer named Benjamin Crump. Now, of course, you know, he doesn't do anything about it. Because he obviously, he's a part of the club, and he doesn't want to rock the boat, and he doesn't want to tell these people, and these people apparently, I don't know how, you know, whether they're just a bunch of dumb hicks or whatever, that they don't and go to the court and, you know, present their own presentment, you know? It just kind of, you know, it just surprised me how stupid people are. If they're ever going to wake up to this shit.
Well, there's something wrong there. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something wrong here.
Well, if you have a chance, take a look at it.
It's like politics as usual. You know, it's who you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. Because
who knew it's
interesting because it's like, you know, of course it's an old boy network, and you would think that, you know, her lawyer, Benjamin Crump, being black, would be sympathetic to the fact that the woman who was shot was also black, you know, but instead he's not. His allegiance apparently is to the bar and to his other corrupt colleagues in it, you know. He's not interested in doing justice.
No, it doesn't sound right at all. And you would think now they would be more sensible to those facts, you know what I mean?
You would think.
That's what's going on. And, of course, you know, the deep state, the New World Order, right now they want more chaos. So they're not going to make the right decision. You know,
right.
It didn't fit their agenda, so they made it go the way they wanted it to go.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, I'll send you a copy of that article so you can familiarize yourself with it and maybe make a comment next week or something,
yeah,
because I think it's very interesting what's going on there.
It sounds very fishy to begin with, just what you just told me. I don't like the smell of it already, you know what I mean? I don't know all what all the particulars are. And you know what? More might come out in the future, too.
Well, that's the interesting about it, is this woman got shot like 6 months ago. And only relatively recently, you know, did the shit hit the fan, you know, with regard to all the implications of what... Because basically what they did, they tried to sweep it under the rug, but with all this stuff that's going on, you know, with all these other people being shot, it finally, you know, people started to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, what about her? What about me, you know?
Yeah. Kind of like the Me Too thing, right?
Right, exactly.
But,
so anyway, that's all I had to say. I'll send you a copy of
the
article.
And maybe I can find out something else on it, but it doesn't smell, it smells like it has a problem to me.
Right. But, you know, it just pisses me off kind of that these people are so stupid that they can't figure out that the grand jury belonged to the people. You know, the prosecutor should keep the nose out of everything, you know?
Well, I mean, the grand jury decided that the cops did the right thing, but the prosecutor presented it in such a way to them that you could argue that they were tainted, right?
Well, they did the same thing in my case, you know?
In other words, yeah, they sent it to a grand jury, but he only said you got to consider this and this. You see,
right.
That's too much control over the grand jury. It's not right.
And yeah, it's interesting because you know, they indicted me for having an assault weapon and a large high capacity magazine, and lo and behold, I found out later on that after I did my appeals and stuff, is that what they were supposed to do once they confiscated your weapons, they're supposed to do a forfeiture proceeding. Never did that. So now apparently, what happened with my property, it's in probably the you know. A closet of the prosecutor or whomever, you know, but it just kind of disappeared. So I'm going to contact the FBI and the Homeland Security and say, what the hell are these people doing? You know, you want to get these guns off the street? Why aren't they following the law? Why is this shit just disappearing into thin air?
Yeah, because there's two systems of justice.
Right. Because I wrote several Freedom of Information Act requests to the person in charge of that in Bergen County where this happened, and they denied every one of my requests because obviously they're all covering up for each other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway. That's about all I had to say.
You should keep track of it because there has to be a chain of command there, and if that thing disappears, that's another indictment. They can't even sell that. That has to go through a whole process.
That's right. The forfeiture action, you know?
Yeah.
It can't just disappear, which is what they're saying happened, you know?
It disappeared. They don't know where it is. So,
exactly.
Well, it's going to turn up in a crime now? It's kind of like
that's what I'm thinking, you know?
Is it one of those guns that they... when what's his name was running guns there?
an AR-15 knockoff. It was called an X-Men.
I understand, but it's like they allowed this gun to disappear, you know?
Right,
like,
exactly. Now, and this is all part of this whole scam where they filed false criminal charges against me as executor of my father's estate in order to steal it. But they didn't stop there, you know. Then they end up stealing, I don't know what happened, but they never did an accounting of the personal property of the estate. So they, you know, I think my sister stole some of that too. But they—that's the whole thing. They don't do any kind of accounting. They don't follow the law. They don't do what they're supposed to do.
So you inherited this gun? Is that what happened? It was in his estate?
No, no. It was my personal property.
Oh.
But when my sister alleged that I threatened her to kill her, which is not true. And the other thing is that, so she comes over to the house. She wasn't even living there, okay? I lived there. And the thing about this is that she just barges in. There were no exigent circumstances which require, before she even barges in, she called the cops, okay, to force her way into the house where she did not live. And then the prosecutor gets her on the stand and tried to get her to change her testimony before the jury, trying to say that, oh, well, I called him first before I barged into the house. Because the cops said I had to let her in there or they're going to arrest me. I mean, this whole thing is really crazy. And,
now, how did you make out with those charges? Is it done? Or?
Oh, I was... They dropped the assault weapon. No, they dropped. Yeah, actually, they dropped both of them, the assault weapon and the large capacity magazine. Okay, it wasn't an illegal assault weapon. Okay, and it wasn't a large capacity magazine. But they just throw this shit in there just so that they can see what hits the fan.
Well, I think you'll be happy losing the gun and getting away with the charges. That's why they do that.
Right. Right. So, I went through this thing, the trial, and then the whole thing was a farce. My trial lawyer was pathetic. He wasn't prepared, and we didn't appeal. We did a good appeal, and we really exposed them as being racketeers. And my appellate lawyer said, look, even if you believed everything that my sister said, she said that the alleged threat was conditional and transitory. It was not even a terrorist threat according to the law. So what they're doing is they're putting their own,
their own
interpretation of what a terroristic threat is. So they just,
Well, that was big 4 or 5 years ago,
It was actually a lot longer than that, but it's all fraud, and there's no statute of limitations of fraud. You know what I'm doing? Is I just got my I got a webcam today, and I'm getting a nice microphone, and I'm going to start a public access channel, and I'm going to start exposing all the shit that they're doing and putting it up on YouTube.
Well, listen, if you get any good videos or any good news, you send them to Ollie too, so we can put them on Q17 News. We're looking for citizen reporters, so. Anything
good.
You get,
good.
We also have a platform that you can put them on that they'll go further. You know what I mean?
Right, right. I've been following that.
Yeah. So.
By the way, how come you didn't put the the judge's the court thing,
because the judge said you cannot record it or reproduce it or whatever. And
really?
I never did find out, technically we're not supposed to, pass that around.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not really surprised.
Somebody recorded it regardless because they put it on an electronic media over the phone, and she goes, you can't record this or reproduce it or retransmit it. Meanwhile, they got 60, 80 people on a phone line that they're not even controlling in the first place. How do you think you can control that recording? And I don't really believe that legally they can control that recording because there was a court recorder who was typing it, and then there's a tape in the courtroom, but that phone call, that's something different. That's outside of the normal auspices of the court. Like, how can they say that can't be public information, or that you can't FOIA request that, or that you should be able to get that thing for the cost of the DVD and them pushing the button, which Bob Schultz took them to court and won that case. So I don't know if anybody called them up to see if they could actually get that thing, and I don't believe that she can tell you that you can't
I don't believe that. I don't believe that she can, because I've seen something.
Well, she started out. That was part of her rules. You cannot record or reproduce this cult.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
You know, when you go in a courtroom, you like a lot of the courtrooms, they don't allow cameras, and they don't allow. You know, it's up to the judge, first of all. And we went through that when we had our court watcher system, and we found out that as long as they knew ahead of time that you were going to tape it and there was no objections, like, you know, if you're in a family court situation and there's private and personal stuff, they won't let you record it because you got children, you know what I mean? You got people's reputations and stuff that needs to be kept under kind of wraps, you know? But that's the only time I can see where there would, and that would be, you know, exigent, you know, circumstances that you know, it's the exception. It should be not the rule. It should be the exception, right? Because anybody's free to sit in that court and listen to it. You ever see the newspapers where the guy's sketching because they won't let cameras in? And they do pencil sketches of the guy testifying?
Yeah, right, right.
And so, I don't know. I don't get that whole thing. Maybe Brent can comment on some of that stuff. I don't know where they get off with all this stuff like that. I mean, if I can sit there and I can listen, I can be a court watcher, and I could write an affidavit, that's kind of reproducing the court, isn't it? In a manner of speaking. In other words, it's my version of what went on, you know? But, and that's why we like people doing affidavits of what they heard in court, because that's a good deterrent against them changing the written record, because, you know, just like that, just go, oh, the recorder can't hear what you're saying, you know, and
right.
We've had that in our other things where he says, strike that doesn't go on a record, that was not right, blah, blah, you know,
right.
So, and they do keep a recording to check the transcript, the written transcript of the court reporter, that, you know, if there's a discrepancy, that master recording is supposed to be, you know, what settles any dispute over the transcript. But now you got a phone conversation, a phone testimony. That's a third thing entering into the picture that I don't know that if they made any laws on that particularly, or if it's just up to the judge's discretion, you know.
I think it's up to the judge's discretion. Because,
well, it always was up to the judge's discretion. You're right, because sometimes they let us record them anyway. When we had that fellow working for us doing the court reporters, he was recording them. And as long as we let the judge know a day or two or something ahead of time, they usually let us record them. So there you go.
Right. Well,
you know,
what's interesting is
that we need to find out more of this, because now if we're going to be going on cases and they're going to be doing this electronic media and stuff, we really need to nail down where the law is on that, you know. And I mean, you know, look at common law, common sense, all that stuff. In my life, it would seem to me that you should be able to get that with no trouble, without any kind of problems. But obviously, you know, she's saying you can't reproduce this and retransmit it.
Well, what's interesting is in New York federal court, they require that you give up your phone, okay? Because they don't, obviously, I think the reason is they not only for interruption, but they don't want people recording stuff. But in New Jersey, they don't have that rule.
Even in the state
court.
They take your phone, a lot of them.
In New Jersey, they don't, in federal court.
Yeah, see, that's funny. So I guess each court's making its own rules up.
That's what I'm thinking, too. It's all BS.
Yeah. Which I think they feel they have the right to do that. And that might be in part of the law. I don't know. This is a good question to bring up next week, so that we can ask Brent and find out, you know, if anybody else out there that's familiar with the court system understands this more, we can throw some more light on.
Right.
But anyway, we're past 12 now, so.
Right. Okay. Well, it's good talking to you.
Yep. Okay. I guess we're going to end it here. Thank you for coming. We've had a very busy night. We'll be back here next week, same time. And keep your powder dry and pray for the nation, because we're going into a very tough time right now. Very tough.
So, all right. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, Terry. Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.